The case of Michael Wayne Stallings versus the Commonwealth. And just as a reminder, there are sign-in sheets. If you have not yet signed in, if you will please sign in, and then we will start with the proceedings. Yes, sir.
So Matt, I think I'd like to start off, I don't know if it was noticed, but I guess just go at the end of the trial in discussing the Sierra case. I attributed Sierra to Eugene Humphreys, and of course I think Judge Petty. So Matt, I mean, no offense to either.
To either. I should have checked my horoscope this morning.
I was kind of hoping to not see other of you on the panel, but
I'm just a ray of sunshine, aren't I?
it's an opinion that I found insightful, and actually I think was the origin of the thoughts that led to this appeal on behalf of Mr. Stallings. So I think it's probably a good place to start. This is a sufficiency appeal. It's an appeal that has to do with the nature of the substance and whether there is evidence sufficient on that one particular element. We contend that there is not, and further that the record is pretty clear that was the analysis the trial court was looking at in making the determination of guilt. It's the issue that was in front of the court. That's where all of this business that we've gotten into with pharmacy regulations, FDA actions, other pharmacological resources that are referenced in the brief, because that was really an issue that I think was high on the mind of the trial court, and that's why when I made the reference to Sierra, without saying the name of the case, but essentially attributing falsely the holding to your authorship, the judge immediately found Mr. Stallings guilty. What we have here is an orange and white pill bottle, one of two in the cases that happened. These were co-defendants, and my client was the nephew of the other person whose pills these were, according to my client's testimony. He picked up the pill bottle, which was not introduced into evidence, had it in a cargo pocket.
The evidence like most favorable to the Commonwealth is, you know, your client and his companion gave false information about their identities. Your client had the drugs in his possession, but he claimed they were his companions, but there was no label on the pill bottle, so in terms of whether or not he was aware of the nature and character, as Sierra points out, you don't necessarily have to know what the drugs are,
right,
as long as the Commonwealth establishes that you're aware that they're some kind of a controlled substance. And explain why under the totality of these circumstances that wouldn't be a logical conclusion for a fact finder to draw.
Well, I mean, certainly I think that's an excellent question, and exactly
that's why I only ask an excellent question.
I think that you've got to start with the identity fraud, which was, I think, I forget whether it was the first or second issue in the petition that wasn't granted. This was the uncle giving my client's name first. I think that's uncontested. That's the range that he then made up a name. Having essentially the options of I give my name and I blow my uncle's cover, or I make up a name, or I guess he just sits there and doesn't say anything, and that probably looks most suspicious of all, and he made the choice that he made. But I think that colors the consideration of what's going on with these pills. You know, this isn't just dishonesty that has been born out of nowhere, as we see with a lot of these forgery of public record and identity fraud cases, but it's born of his uncle using his name and kind of leaving him as a man without a name. So we'd submit that that's a big part of why this evidence isn't sufficient. And then there's also the trial court's emphasis on the pill bottle, which is interesting because the uncle was charged with possession of marijuana in a identical type of pill bottle, neither of which came into evidence. But obviously the marijuana wasn't issued in a orange and white pill bottle. I think we all know the pharmacies in Virginia, they don't do that. Even if there may be some other places out west where that happens. But sort of just making sure I fully answer your question, it's because of the particular circumstances of the case. While looking at the facts in writing in a vacuum, as to a degree that's what this court has to do.
Well, it sounds like you're simply arguing that the fact finder should have put a different spin or take a different take on the evidence that was presented, and that of course is the fact finder's prerogative, and we don't interfere with that.
And certainly, and I would say I am telling you that, but I also think that given these particular circumstances, this rises to the level of the facts just simply not being there. We don't have, though we do have the name issue, we don't have furtive movements, attempts to get rid of the pill bottle, anything of that nature on behalf of Mr. Stallings. Mr. Stallings, as the Commonwealth pointed out, did take the stand, and he offered explanation as to what happened.
The explanation was that he thought it was a prescription medication for his uncle, I guess, or
well,
whatever.
I think
and the pill bottle had no indication of it being a prescription on it.
Well, I mean, I think that he indicated that it was medication. I don't think he indicated it was prescription medication. And I think that's the distinction, because not every prescription medication is even on Schedules 1 through 5 of the Controlled Substance Act.
You're not going to fight a prescription for anything in Schedule 1, that's for sure.
Well, no, certainly, but 2 through 5, I suppose I should say. Schedule 6, I think, is an interesting issue that's sort of left to be explored in terms of Sierra, because it says, in essence, anything that doesn't fall in 2 through 5 that has to be dispensed by a pharmacist with essentially some interesting exceptions, the codeine sulfate until the FDA withdrew it, the plan B where the FDA indicated specifically this has to be available behind the pharmacy counter, but it's in no way anything else.
Well, doesn't the fact that this appear to be the kind of pill bottle that's dispensed from a pharmacy, but it had no label, and then the contents were actually inside a baggie that was stuffed in the pill bottle. Doesn't that, aren't those among the circumstances that would support a finding that this individual understood the nature of the drugs that he was carrying?
We would contend no, that it wouldn't be. That certainly these are all circumstantial things. But given the pharmacy regulations and the state of essentially pharmacy law is outlined in the brief, that these are not issues that would give rise to the appropriate standard of circumstantial evidence, that being evidence that viewed in its totality is completely consistent with guilt and in no way consistent with innocence. And that's because there are things that a pharmacist can, for convenience sake or whatever else, put in an amber bottle, and a pharmacist, in addition, in terms of sort of Venn diagramming this out, doesn't have to put something that's in a prescription in a bottle, sort of think about a Z-pack or something like that comes in its own bubble card.
But doesn't the pharmacist put them with a label, and does the pharmacist put them in a baggie and put them in a bag in a pharmaceutical type of bottle, the orange and white or whatever, label it. And if it doesn't have a label and it's in a baggie in one of those without a label, but it is the type of bottle that comes from a pharmacy, isn't that stuff that the trier of fact gets to evaluate and weigh in deciding whether there's some kind of criminal intent?
Oh, yes, I think that it's something that they get to weigh. And I think that that's exactly what happened here, and I don't think this is merely we're taking issue with the way that it was weighed. We're taking issue with the, given the way that it was weighed, whether this meets the appropriate legal standard, given the posture of this case. And we contend that it doesn't. And it's for the reasons that we've suggested in terms of the pharmaceutical regulations and the state of pharmacy today.
Well, all this would seem to indicate that it's not for the appropriate, proper pharmaceutical steps, but for something inappropriate.
Well, and certainly, I think the concern there is maybe it is, but I don't think it's a situation where
that well, then is you can add things like false name and all this other stuff, and can't you eventually build up to where you reach the bar?
Well, I contend certainly in the abstract, if the false name did not have the origin that it had, that I think is clear, and I think the trial court was clearly sympathetic to, even though it found him guilty of that offense, because my uncle took my name is not an offense to that crime. That can't be one of the things used to justify this conviction, because of the findings that the trial court made about that offense and about the circumstances, and so we're left just with the pill bottle at that point. And that's the reason that there was not evidence that was sufficient, and the insufficiency of evidence survives the very high standard of review here, because that's, you know, in the end, what we have and the power that we have.
Just so you're aware, you're in your rebuttal time.
Unless there are other questions, I will save everything.
Yes, sir. Rebuttal. Thank you.
Hey, please, the court. Chris Chandler for the Commonwealth. As the court has noted, this is a. The issue in this case is whether or not Mr. Stallings knowingly possessed a controlled substance. And the question is not whether he knew which controlled substance he possessed, just simply whether he knew that he possessed a controlled substance, period. And that's from Sierra versus Commonwealth. Guilty knowledge cases necessarily, absent a confession, rely upon circumstantial evidence. And that is what the Commonwealth relied upon in this case to make its case that Mr. Stallings knowingly possessed a controlled substance. The Supreme Court of Virginia has said in Young versus Commonwealth that certain circumstantial evidence cases do not meet the threshold where they can survive appellate review. And those cases are cases where the Commonwealth relies solely on actual possession of a controlled substance to prove knowledge. In Young in particular, all the evidence of the knowledge in that case that the Commonwealth had was the fact that there was actual possession in the purse of this pill bottle containing narcotics. The reason the Commonwealth did not have any additional evidence of guilty knowledge was because in that case, the Commonwealth, or the trial court, sustained a motion to suppress. As a result, the defendant's statements did not come into evidence. The defendant did not testify at trial. And there was a witness who testified at trial that the prescription pills were hers, and she was able to produce a valid prescription for those narcotics. Now that is a case where the evidence does not rise to the sufficient level to prove guilty knowledge. This is clearly not that case. In this case, we have the defendant's statements at the scene. He made false and evasive statements when he gave a false identification. He did not, as he claimed in his testimony and continues to claim on appeal, give that false identification 15 to 20 minutes after his uncle gave a false ID. The officer's testimony was that they were both asked for the identifications at about the same time, and they both gave false identifications at about the same time. So he lied about his identification at the stop. He lied a second time after the officers found the narcotics on his person, the prescription pills on his person, which does support the reasonable inference that he was lying because he knew that he was in possession of a controlled substance. And of course, then again, at trial, he testified in his defense. He lied about when he was asked, and he lied about how many times he was asked for his identification, each supporting the inference that he's lying about his guilty knowledge. So this is a defendant who lied early, he lied often, and he also lied poorly, I would submit to the court. In reading his testimony on the record as to how he came to be in possession of this pill bottle, he claimed that he came into possession of this pill bottle because his uncle asked him to retain these pills for him. But it took him a couple pages and a couple paragraphs of explaining and kind of dodging the question to even get to that ultimate answer. So I would submit that his testimony was unconvincing, and also that he lied poorly because his asserted defense turned out to be incriminating once he realized what he was admitting to. So his testimony that, well, I concluded that these pills, quote unquote, were okay, and this is on pages 108 through 109 of the appendix, he concluded the pills were okay because he saw this list in the truck along with the pill bottles, and this list had a list of 8 or 9 different medications, and they all had really long, complicated sounding names that he couldn't pronounce. And so by seeing the pills with this list, he concluded they were okay. Now if he had assumed that these were Tylenol or Advil or allergy medications, one, he more likely would have been able to pronounce the names, Tylenol and Advil, and secondly, he would not have had to conclude that they quote-unquote were okay, because of course it is permissible to have Tylenol and Advil. So when he was pressed on cross-examination, this was a prescription list, so you knew that they were prescription pills.
Is there a legal principle you want us to adopt that the more syllables and the name of the drug, the more likely it is to be a controlled substance?
I'm not asking for any legal principle, but I would assert that it's a reasonable inference that a trial court could draw from his testimony. Then when he was pressed, he kind of backed off and said, no, I didn't actually know that they were prescription pills. Perhaps at that point he realized that his asserted defense was not so favorable to his case as he might have otherwise thought it was. So under these circumstances, his lies at the scene, his false testimony at trial, and then of course his actual possession, while not sufficient standing by itself, that still is a factor that the trial court could consider. He didn't only possess, as the court has noted, it wasn't a prescription pill bottle with a label that appeared to be valid. It was an unlabeled pill bottle, pills stuck in a baggie and then stuffed inside of the bottle. That supports a reasonable inference that one, that this is a controlled substance, but two, that it's not obtained pursuant to a valid prescription. And then finally, I would also assert that there's been a lot of back and forth about whether or not he might have possibly been under the mistaken impression that these had been obtained from a valid prescription. But the statute, 18.2250, while it does create an exception for possession of pills that have been obtained pursuant to a valid prescription, there was no evidence in this case of a valid prescription other than Mr. Stallings' testimony, self-serving testimony, that he thought he was holding them for his uncle, and he thought perhaps they were okay because he'd seen this list. So I would assert that there is no mistake of fact defense for thinking that they were validly prescribed when it turns out they weren't in fact validly prescribed, unless you can somehow produce a prescription to support your defense that there is actually a valid prescription. That's what the defendant was able to do in Young.
Making it an affirmative defense.
Correct, Your Honor. That would be what I would submit based on my reading of the statute. So here, the trial court could have done one or two things. Could have rejected his testimony that he mistakenly believed that they'd been obtained pursuant to a valid prescription and concluded, no, you knew that they hadn't been. Or secondly, concluded, even if that claim he actually did believe that, there was no evidence in the record of a valid prescription, and therefore he knowingly possessed a controlled substance that had not been obtained pursuant to a valid prescription. So I would also just for the sake of the record, note that the defendant had his driver's license on him at the time of the stop. So this claim that his identity had been stolen by his uncle and then he was left with nothing to do but to steal somebody else's, if he had wanted to assert his own identity, he had the means by which to do that, and yet he chose not to. It's certainly reasonable for the trial court to conclude that he was lying about his identity because of his guilty knowledge of the controlled substance that he had in his pocket. So unless there are any further questions from the court, I'm happy to rest on my brief.
Hearing none, we thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Smallwood, your remaining time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I wanted to search through the appendix and get to the question I think that you asked Judge Humphreys about the admission of prescription. I think that it's 107 of the joint appendix. And I think the issue is that it's asked as a compound question, which I guess I didn't catch in the heat of the trial. Okay, and you knew that these were prescription pills. You knew he took them for medical purposes. Yes, sir. So, I mean, he's being asked about two different things, and then the assistant Commonwealth attorney goes on about a half page later and asks more specifically, you knew they were prescription pills, and he says no. So that's where I'm getting the idea that he said no to that.
But then just a few lines down, question, okay, that was in a prescription pill bottle, yeah, orange bottle, white lid.
Right.
Okay.
Certainly, and I think that gets us right back to the issue with the bottle. And certainly we don't have any evidence of there being a label or anything. The bottle was not offered into evidence in the case. But a orange and white bottle without a label, we would contend, is just a container. Essentially, the analysis reads it as no different than if it were in a purse or a pocket or anything else. Without the label, it's just that it loses its character as this must be what it's labeled out as. It doesn't gain any more sinister appearance or weight or anything than that. And it is interesting, and I know that I missed it, the Jones case, I believe it is, that the Commonwealth presents and attempts to distinguish. I had not found any cases that had to do with a unlabeled pill bottle, and they found one, and we'd submit that it further leads to the conclusion that this conviction should be overturned, and I don't know that there would be anything else that would need to be remanded for the court than vacating the order. We would ask you to do something.
Very well. We thank you, sir. In keeping with the tradition of this court, we'll come down and greet counsel, and thereafter we will take up the case of Brenton Jones versus the Commonwealth.